As you may have heard, our last program is this Friday, August 1st. Over the course of the week, we'll be having conversations with many of the people we've counted as our regulars over the years. But we are going to start off the week by looking forward to the future of NPR. As you may know, Jarl Mohn became the president and CEO of NPR on July 1st. He is no stranger to the world of media. He was the founding president and CEO of the media investment company Liberty Digital. Before that, he was a senior executive at MTV and VH1. He helped found and lead E! Entertainment Television. He also spent quite a few years as an on-air DJ. His on-air name was Lee Masters, and he's been serving most recently as chair of Southern California Public Radio. But he's taken on his current position at a difficult time. Budget problems led NPR to make cuts to its newsroom, which included our program. This has raised many questions about the network's commitment to diversity at the network and how the organization can rebound from much recent management turnover and budget troubles. And Jarl Mohn was kind enough to join us now in our Washington, D.C. studios. He took the long trip downstairs to talk more about his goals as NPR's new leader. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So were you drafted or did you volunteer?
I was asked to serve, and I thought, wow, this would be great. This is really an important thing and important to me, too.
Well, what made you want to take on this challenge at this point in your life? I mean, you could be forgiven if you just wanted to, you know, sit on your porch and drink iced tea, or you've already done a lot of things in your career. Keep riding your mountain bike.
And I was doing a lot of that. But I was engaged for the last 12 years, although not in a day-to-day doing any one specific thing. I was doing 20 things, a handful of which were not-for-profits. And of all the things I did, from the investments to my mountain biking to not-for-profit work, the thing that I got the most pleasure out of was being involved with KPCC in Southern California Public Radio. I was involved there for 12 years. I got more out of it personally. So when this came up and I was asked about it, the light went off in my head and I said, I have to do this.
What do you think is your most important skill or experience that you bring to this enterprise?
Well, most important skill. I think, like you, I like to listen to people. I like to talk to people. And I think the great successes I've had in my career are the result of collaboration and working with people and finding solutions. So I think that would probably be the thing that's most appropriate and meaningful here.
It's been reported that NPR is still running a budget deficit going into the 2014 fiscal year. Is there something that listeners should make of this? Is there something that the audience should be thinking about?
Well, for this year, the year we're currently in, yes. But for the year ahead, the budget deficits have been fixed. So, again, that's the plan on paper. We have to make it happen.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with NPR's new president and CEO, Jarl Mohn. We're talking about him a little bit and also talking about his plans for moving the organization forward. So obviously on this program, we have a particular interest in the whole question of diversity in the media and more broadly,
yes,
you know, diversity in the
yes
country. You said that you believe this organization has a commitment to diversity. Obviously, some people question that. So what makes you say that?
I believe it to be true. I really do. Could we be doing more? Should we be doing more? Yes, absolutely. Will we be doing more? Absolutely. But if you compare us to our peers or our colleagues in media in general, I think we're a leader already. That's not an excuse not to do more. I want us to be, by far, the leader in media in diversity.
And what does that mean?
I think it means a couple of things. The first is in terms of who we hire. What does our staff look like? And we need to set the standard for what hiring is in public media. Well, in all media, not just public media. That's the first piece. I think if we get that right, if we move in the right direction and we improve that, the next thing that changes is content, because now we have different voices, we have different points of view, and I think the points of view are probably more important than the voices. We have different names. That impacts the way the content sounds, and that changes the third piece, which is the audience. We want the audience to be representative of the United States. Now, not everybody's going to listen to public radio, but I'm talking about people that are engaged, people that vote, people that are interested in the news. There's some people that are not. I don't think we're going to get those people, but we can widen the circle.
So obviously we're not going to relitigate the decision around this program because that would be pointless. But on the subject of diversity in regards to this program, the New York Times quoted you as saying, it was probably right, diversity has to make sense in the business context. What does that mean?
It means that we should not just do diversity content if it doesn't ultimately make business sense.
But what does that mean? I mean, a lot of people think news doesn't make business sense. I mean, if you
just,
were thought
but
about...
But I would argue, okay, with them. I would argue, okay, with them.
Right.
Yeah. And but I really believe diversity can make sense. And I think it will make sense if done properly. And that means that the whole organization has to get behind it. You know, the idea of doing individual shows for individual audiences as a programmer does not work for me. I think kind of the plan that's now afoot for you and for your team, having a greater presence on Morning Edition, having a greater presence on All Things Considered, I think serves everybody in a big way, because it's introducing to an already successful show, an already successful large audience, and giving the opportunity for more people to feel like that programming is for them.
The ombudsman, mm-hmm, outgoing, mm-hmm, ombudsman, published an analysis of racial diversity at NPR in connection, mm-hmm, with the complaints that he'd gotten by, or the, let's, yep, just say the reaction that he got from many people in the audience, mm-hmm, related to this program. You know, a number of people quarrel with his analysis in a number of areas. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you
read
his analysis. Is there anything about it that struck you?
Yeah, there were actually a couple of things. And I read it a few times because I'm just trying to acquaint myself with, you know, what the data is. The first thing that struck me was, if you look at the benchmarks that are out there, whether it's comparing the newsroom here at NPR with the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal or the LA Times or the Washington Post or the New York Times, this organization does a good job. It really does do a good job. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. There's some areas that we are really far behind on, particularly Latinos, and we have to improve. So my first comment was, a lot of people have been flogging themselves. And the important thing is to say what we've done well or reasonably well to date, and what kind of guidelines or benchmarks do we want to set for ourselves? What kind of aspirations do we want to set for ourselves? Because we have to set higher aspirations. So my first takeaway on that was, we're doing a lot better than I thought we were. And now what I want to understand is, what's the right construct for us to look at to determine, have we succeeded? Or are we getting closer to success? Are we moving in the right direction? And are we moving fast enough?
One of the findings of, again, a number of people quarrel with the ombudsman's metrics, mm-hmm, that he selected, and I take it that you question some of them as well. But one of the findings was that 87% of NPR listeners overall are white, mm-hmm, and that's 15% higher than in the general, mm-hmm, population. And I just wanted to ask why you think that is.
Well, I think it's a process. I don't think we're going to change that number until we change the number inside. I think we have to start there. I don't think it's possible to get a diverse audience unless the people that are creating the shows, creating the points of view, raising the topics, raising the issues, are here doing that work. We have to have that first.
But you already pointed out that compared to other newsrooms that you are aware of, there seems to be a, I'm going to take your word for it because I know what's going on in my staff, but mm-hmm, there already seems to be a more diverse workforce here, yeah, than exists in a number of other media outlets. So what's the problem? Is it a leadership problem? Well, is it a fact that people are here but they don't have enough agency to actually get things done? What's the issue? What's the problem?
Well, I would have to look at the audience composition of those other institutions as well. If we're going to compare, mm-hmm, the staffing levels of NPR to, say, the New York Times, and we know what our audience composition is. I don't know the audience composition of the New York Times, mm-hmm, or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the LA Times. Then I can say, what's the gap between the staffing and the audience? So I don't know that we're doing better or worse. I know we're doing better on the staffing side. I don't know if we're doing better or worse on the audience side. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of getting immersed in this. But I want you to know, because I know you asked me at the town hall meeting first thing, who's going to hold you responsible? What are the benchmarks and milestones going to be? I don't think you know this. My very first day on the job, July 1st, my very first meeting, at 10 o'clock in the morning, we had the management, the top 25 executives of the organization met. After I said hello and thanked them for being so welcoming to me, the very first topic that we discussed was diversity. And what are we going to do? What are the benchmarks so that we know, are we moving in the right direction? Are we getting better? Are we getting worse? Is it showing up in audience? Because I don't question the commitment. The folks here really seem deeply committed to the idea of diversity. maybe they're executing, maybe they're not, maybe they have a good plan, maybe they don't. But we're gonna codify it. We're gonna make sure that everybody buys in to not just the concept, but what our plan is to address it. And most importantly, to your question originally when I did the town hall meeting, how am I going to be measured? How are we going to be measured?
Before we let you go, NPR posted a job description of the ombudsman post that said that the officer would not be passing judgment or providing commentary, and that there was some public controversy about that. And you changed that message. Tell me why you changed that wording. Was it just a boneheaded mistake, or did you feel it sent a poor message? Or
well, I thought it was a mistake. I don't think it was the right decision. I think an ombudsman, which I can't say very well. Can I call it the public editor? I think that they need to reach conclusions. And that's what we're paying them to do. I think that role, you know, a public editor, is hugely important to the credibility and integrity of this organization. Anything that we do that diminishes that is wrong. We reverse that decision.
We have a segment we call Wisdom Watch, where we ask people who've made a difference through their work what their word of wisdom is to people who might like to follow in their footsteps. And I wanted to ask, do you mind if you give us a word of wisdom? I mean, if you were offering advice based on the way you've managed your career, what do you think it might be?
Nothing matters more than people.
Yarl Mohn is president and CEO of NPR. He was kind enough to join us in our studios, now his studios, in Washington, D.C. Yarl Mohn, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk about matters of personal finance. As we have mentioned, this is the last week of our program, and that means many of us are finding ourselves in transition. Some are going to new jobs here in this building. Some are trying their hands at freelancing. And while all that's going on, some are welcoming new family members. We figure we're not alone in this. So for our last Money Coach conversation on this program anyway, we decided to gather some of the people who've been nice enough to give us some good advice over the years to talk about managing money during transitions. Joining us now are personal finance expert Luis Barajas, with us from Irvine, California, from Cleveland, Plain Dealer, consumer columnist Cheryl Harris, and Alvin Hall, a financial educator, our original money coach, with us from New York City. Welcome, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're Thanks, welcome. Michelle. Glad to be here.
Thank you, Michelle.
Alvin, you don't sound as glad as you could.
I'm very glad to be here. I'm a little sad.
Oh, well, yeah, me too, Michelle.
Yeah. Well, well, so are we all, but let's make the best of it. So you got to do that. And Alvin, people always say, you know, don't make any big decisions, you know, in a crisis or but you can't help it. I mean, you can't help it. So, for example, if there's a job loss or a sudden job loss, you don't have a choice but to make some decisions. So what's the first thing you should do when you're faced with something, particularly something unexpected?
Try to avoid making any decisions when your emotions are very high or you feel a lot of anxiety, because almost always that indicates you're going to lose your perspective on the situation. So take some time and start taking notes on things that you need to take care of, things you need to look at financially, and then prioritize those things over a time as you gain a little bit more calm about the situation. Because I've been in that situation where you walk into an office one day and your boss says to you, this is your last day on the job, and you walk out of there almost starstruck, just dumbstruck by the situation. And so what I tell everybody, take some time and calm down and start to prioritize those things you need to pay attention to.
Cheryl, what about you? Obviously, if you're faced with sudden job loss or some kind of a, you know, something like that, you're going to have to adjust your budget. But what do you do first? What do you do first?
Well, what I think is, first of all, don't make your situation worse. Don't start adding new debts. You know, try to look at, you know, the payments that you have, the income that you actually have on hand, the payments that you have going out, especially debt payments and credit card payments. The two biggest payments that you want to be able to keep making are your house payments or, you know, rent, keep a roof over your head, and a car payment. So I think you're just going to have to kind of prioritize payments. There is a wonderful, wonderful website for anyone who gets caught flat-footed by a layoff or a job loss. It's the extension site, extension.org. These are the home extension agent and home ec people, they have a, if you go to that website, extension.org, and type in managing money in tough times, they have everything from how to barter for services, how to cut your food budget. I mean, they are practical and wonderful tips, and I recommend them to everyone all the time.
Lewis, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I always use a formula called E plus R equals O, where the E equals the events, and sometimes you just can't control the events in your life. And so what happens is most people react by giving a knee-jerk reaction to those events. And the O stands for outcome, so E plus R equals O. So what I do is I shift them to the outcomes. Okay, something's happened, you can't change that. Let's focus on the outcome. Instead of reacting to what's happened, let's respond. What do we need to do? And then create a plan for that.
So, Lewis, let's go the other way. Let's say you've just gotten a promotion or a big bump or something like that. Lewis, what's the first thing you do or you recommend that people do when something like that happens?
Well, again, I want to clearly communicate with them or have them communicate what are they trying to accomplish. If they're behind the eight ball with their retirement, now's a wonderful time not to use that extra money when they've gotten a promotion. It's to spend it. It's to actually decide how much more are we going to contribute to the retirement plan or how much more can we add to the children's education. So it's going back and kind of going back to the basics and looking at their budget and seeing how that extra income is going to actually create some changes in their lives.
So, Lewis, you know what? Sometimes people recommend that you take a little bit of a bump and blow it just so that you can have that experience of doing it. I mean, I've heard people give that advice to somebody who's gotten like a big windfall, like a lottery or something like that, where they just, or some kind of unexpected windfall, a bonus, where you designate a portion of it to do something stupid just so that you can feel. Do you believe in that, or you think that's just sends you down the wrong path?
That's hilarious because almost everyone that I meet these days is blowing it whether they have the money or not, right?
Okay.
They're taking the vacation. So at some point, I'm saying, look, you've had enough chance, you know, whether you've been on a diet, you've been blowing it. Now's the time to really get on a diet, and right now's the time to really start saving. So again, I want to kind of clarify that they want to make sure that this extra money that just came to their hands, sure, fine, go out and have a great dinner, but let's get it to use and something that's really important in their lives.
You know,
I like the
one-third
rule. You stuff one in your retirement because it's going to work for you. You shove a third of what you're getting into a savings account because nearly everyone in America needs a bigger savings account than they have. And then a third, you can live on it and enjoy the, you know, fruits of your labor. So,
But I wanted to talk to you about freelancing. So some people, when they are faced with a job loss, they say to themselves, you know what, this is the time to do what I really want to do. And so they convert to let me try my hand at freelancing.
Yes.
So I can do more of what I want to do and less of what I don't want to do. Do you have some advice for somebody who just says this is a great opportunity to transition into freelancing? Because I know that that's something that you've done. How do you do that?
Yes, and I was just having a conversation on Saturday with a friend of mine who made this same decision. And I said to him, do you have 3 to 6 months worth of your business expenses in the bank so that you can cover yourself? Because when you start freelancing, you may not have a client on the books at that time, or you may have one or two, but bringing in the new client is going to be a lot more difficult than people think. The second point I make is be prepared to work harder than you've ever worked in your life. Because when you work for a company, the check comes in, administration gets taken care of. But when you're freelance, you become everything. The marketing person, the billing person, the collection person, the admin person. You have to keep that going and you have to be really organized. And you end up working much harder than you imagine. And the third point is to keep yourself motivated. Don't get so caught up in the work you're doing now that you forget to set aside a certain amount of time to always look toward the future so you can continue to bring in new business. You have to be very organized and very much in control of yourself to succeed at being freelance.
We're having a Money Coach conversation about things to consider when you are in transition. We're talking job loss, salary increase, expanding family, divorce. What are the things that we need to know when life changes? Our guests are financial educator Alvin Hall, consumer columnist Cheryl Harris, and personal finance expert Lewis Baraha. So, you know, expanding a household or family changes, that's a big one for a lot of people. And, you know, we are very happy to report that we're planning to welcome just to put that out there. Don't want anybody to be scared, especially not my husband. But two members of our staff are expecting new additions, and we're really happy about that. But, Cheryl, why don't you talk about that? Because one of the things that I've noticed is people get inundated with stuff, you know, offers for stuff. Do you have some advice about kind of weeding through what's the right
stuff? I do,
and, what's
and
not?
I think that there are tons of useless baby products that people should not waste their money on. I mean, the two biggest purchases that you need to make, good quality new or newer crib, no crib that's older than 10 years old, cribs without cutouts. I mean, cribs are the place where you keep your baby and you're not there to watch them. And it's important to get a really safe, good crib, a good car seat, and preferably one for each car you have, because you're going to be handing off a baby. It just happens, so it's better to have both cars stocked, equipped with really good car seats. And if you're not sure how to put them in, if you go, there's a place in your community, usually it's a fire department that will help you. They'll help you learn how to strap it in so that you install it correctly. What I think you shouldn't buy is a bassinet, and they're so cute and they're so darling. Everybody's got one. They all used it for about 6 weeks, and it's not a good purchase to have. Bumpers, baby bumpers, the crib bumpers, comforters, pillows, those are dangerous. The very first thing your pediatrician is going to tell you is do not put your baby in a crib with pillows, crib bumpers. You have to take all that stuff out because those are suffocation hazards, and they're very real ones. So just go with a plain crib from the start and, you know, decorate after they become toddlers.
Decorate after they become toddlers and throw stuff on the walls. Yeah,
exactly. And the last thing, Michelle, if I can just add, sure, baby bath seats. These are really dangerous things, and the reason they're dangerous is because the way people use them, they think that because a baby is sitting in a ring in water and their head is above water, that they can be distracted for a moment. They can turn their back to answer a phone, leave the room to grab a towel. Baby bath seats should not be in your house, and once you have your baby, don't ever let the babysitter wash the baby for you. I mean, that's a job that you should do. It's a really important job, and I would say tiny baby bathtub maybe, but you have to have hands-on, eyes-on baby at all time when it's in the water. So,
okay. You know, Alvin, a lot of people, when they're expecting, think, I need a bigger place. I need a bigger place. How would you recommend that somebody go about deciding that, whether you need a bigger place or should you even think about, you know, renting versus owning? How do you go about making that decision about when is the right time? I know these days a lot of people are really thinking whether it's in their best interest to own or not.
Yes, I think you look at the impact that the child has upon your life and your budget once the child comes in into the world, because then you get a sense of what your real expenses will be and how that will impact your carrying costs if you go to buy a new house. That old wisdom of buy the biggest house you can afford, even with a kid, because your family's going to expand. It may not be true, because your job situation may be a little iffy not right at this point. The economy may not be doing well. So you need to look at how much of an impact having that child will have on your cash flows, on the money that you have, and then consider buying a house or moving into a property that will suit your budget. And renting is not bad as a bridge between owning two properties. If you already own, maybe it's time to take advantage of the good market that we see in many cities across America and rent for a little while until you can find a house that meets your financial needs that you know you can afford through good times and bad times.
Lewis, what about you? Do you want to add something here? Are there common mistakes you see people make when they either welcome a new addition to the family or get married for the first time or something like that?
Yeah, for new parents, I mean, there's three really big issues that they need to take a look at least from a financial planning standpoint. And one is, for the first time, if they haven't thought about it, is creating an estate plan, having a nomination of guardian, a will, a trust, in case something happens to the parents, what's going to happen to their children. Now, that's really important. The second issue maybe they've never even thought about before they had children was maybe increasing or getting life insurance that will help take care of their families in case something happens to the parents. And at the same time, it's not too early to start thinking about college funding and thinking about what 529 plans or how much money it's going to cost your kids to go to college 18 years from now. Can you imagine what those costs will be? And so those are three key issues for new parents to look at as well.
So, Cheryl, to the opposite and going back in the sad direction now, uncoupling, that's, you know, that does happen. Are there common mistakes you think people make? Are there some tips that you would want to give to people who have, you know, made the decision that it's time to sever a relationship, particularly a marriage? Are common mistakes or pitfalls that you think you'd like to help people avoid?
Yeah, one is joint credit cards and joint accounts. If you think you're going to be parting ways, it's really important to get your name off of joint, especially credit card accounts with someone, because a lot of spouses think think sometimes people get very vindictive in those situations. Not everybody's thinking really rationally, and they'll run up a bunch of debts and as sort of a punitive thing with an ex or a soon-to-be ex. And I just want to tell folks, even though a judge may at the end of the divorce say, look, this party is responsible for the bill, that really doesn't play outside of the courtroom. If you both have your names on that account as users, when it goes into debt collection or someone's not paying that bill, they will go after you for the money. It's really hard to dodge those costs. So I would say start uncoupling your finances first. Have your own credit card, especially for women if they have joint accounts. I hope no one does this anymore, but I really hope people have separate credit accounts. But I would start uncoupling those first.
Alvin, any final thought there? Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think that they need to sit down and, as rationally as possible, look at what their lifestyles are going to be like after the divorce. Often there is a diminution of lifestyle that they do not anticipate. And then as they watch as things get smaller, they're struggling more, they become vindictive. Just as Cheryl says, you know, I shouldn't be living this way. Look at what I had before. You have to be really rational when you go through a divorce, and it's a hard thing to do. Look at what your budget is going to be and your lifestyle is going to be after the divorce, and expect it to be smaller.
Lewis, final thought from you on that.
Yeah, there's some huge tax issues. A lot of people, what they do is they just want to get the divorce or the separation over, and what they'll do, they'll just hand over certain assets to the other person. For example, if I get a divorce and I tell my wife, well, you keep the house and I'll keep the 401k, in reality, my wife is getting 100% of the equity in that house, and I may only be getting 70% of what I kept on the retirement plan, because if I were to pull the money out, I'd have to pay taxes on that, where I would not pay taxes on the equity of my personal residence. So be very careful about that, and don't make any knee-jerk reactions.
So Evan, we have a minute left. Since you're our original money coach guy, we've got about a minute and a half left. Do you want to just give us some final thoughts? I just want to say that we appreciate all of you over the years, the advice that you've given, the fact that you've kind of pointed out things that perhaps people don't think about. There, you know, there's lots of people write books. Many of you have written books, but you also talk about kind of the emotional side as well as mm-hmm. just the dollars and cents side. And I really appreciate that in your contributions to this. And also thinking about the ways that people are different in the world. You know, everybody's circumstances are not the same. So we've really appreciated the fact that you've always been mindful of that. But Alvin, we have about a minute left. Do you have any advice for us?
Yes. First of all, it's been great to work with Cheryl, Lewis, and you over all these years. But I think the one thing going forward that all of us need to remember is that people want money to be magic. Even though we sit on this program and we offer them really practical advice, Cheryl's website that she just talked about, Lewis' ideas about taxation, all that sort of stuff, really good. But everybody wants money to be magical. They want to spend it. They want to make their dreams come true without any relationship to reality. One of the things I think all of us need to think about as we talk about money in the public forum is to give people enough freedom so they can fantasize about money, but also bring them back to the level where they can be practical. Encourage them to prioritize what their dreams are and to pursue practical dreams, ones that will make them feel good, but handle money well, because there are always those what-if situations and there's always time ticking away toward retirement.
All right. Alvin Hall, financial educator in New York City. Luis Barajas is a personal finance expert in Irvine, California. Cheryl Harris is the consumer columnist for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. Thank you all so much for joining us. We'll see you on the other side.
Thanks, Michelle.
We're making a transition.
As we begin our final week on the air, we're checking in with some of our favorite guests who've been on during the past 7 years, and one of them is Ayanla Van Zandt. She is a speaker and a spiritual advisor with a unique style. You can see her in action on a show called Ayanla Fix My Life. It's on the OWN Network. Here's a clip from a meeting she had with a crystal meth addict trying to recover.
Anything that threatens, hinders, obstructs, denies, delays your capacity to stand fully up for yourself within yourself, take it down. Now, I'm willing to do that, are you? That would be a no.
Well, We've called upon Ayanla today not so much to fix our lives as to offer some wisdom on how to handle big life changes. We're going through a transition of our own here at Tell Me More, and we figure we're probably not alone in that. A lot of people are changing careers, relationships are starting or ending some chapter in their lives. So we figured who better to help us figure it out than Ayanla Van Sant, and she's with us now once again in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've said in past interviews that you don't give advice, but you give people tools
right.
to deal with their issues. What's the difference?
Well, advice says do this because this is what I think you should do, or do this because it worked for me. And when you give people tools, you give them something that they can keep and use over and over and over again. Because the truth is, we probably have the same challenges and issues over and over and over. I don't say problems because we're powerless to problems. But when we have an issue, when we have a challenge, when we're going through a transition, you simply need tools so that you can work your way through.
One of the tools that you're famous for is the phrase that seems to undergird a lot of the work that you do with people. It's called do the work.
Yeah, do the work.
What does that mean?
That means that you can't look outside of yourself. You must look within yourself and address all of the things that are going on within you and clear out the things that are not useful, whether it's fear or anger or shame or guilt or whatever it is. Clean that stuff up. It's all attached to something that becomes your baggage or your monogram luggage. You know, when you don't clean up your baggage, it becomes monogram luggage, meaning that you hold on to it and you treasure it and you take care of it. People treat luggage differently than they do baggage. So when you do your work, what you're doing is unpacking the baggage so that it doesn't become luggage.
The phrase do the work, I think for some, implies that all the work is your work to do. What about people who are facing changes or transitions that are not of their own making? You know, people who are facing natural disasters or big economic changes. I know you were very candid, including on this program, about what you went through when your house was foreclosed upon. Really, at the beginning of the recession, you made a big point that, you know, as a self-employed person, you experienced a lot of that downturn first.
Yeah.
But so what about it when the event itself is not one that's really of your making?
But the event is not what you're working on. You're working on your response or reaction to an event. You either react to it, that means you become victimized and you say this thing is happening to you, or you respond to it and say the solution must come through you. So what is the solution? And that's where you stay focused, not on the rightness, wrongness, fairness of the event, but on the appropriateness of your response.
What's step number one?
Tell the truth. And that truth may be what you feel, what you're thinking, what your fears are, what your upset is. I say start with the upset. You know, and the upset is your initial reaction to whatever the thing is. And that's normal. You know, we don't like change. The human ego does not like change. And so when something comes that's causing us a change, we go into fear or we go into upset or we go into breakdown, whatever it is. So tell the truth about what you're thinking and what you're feeling. That's the first thing.
So you should say to yourself, I'm really angry, or
yeah,
I'm really afraid.
Yeah,
or
this really pisses me off. And the weasel that did this needs to be stomped with a big old boot. Whatever it is, you know what I mean? But don't say, well, you know, change must come and woo-de-woo-de and stuff your feelings, because feelings buried alive don't die. And that fear or that upset or that anger or that whatever it is, you know, it'll turn into something inside of you. So you want to get it out. So I say, call a thing, tell the truth first. Do that first. And then you need to look at, okay, so what is my next most appropriate step? What's my next most appropriate step? Is there someone I need to speak to? Is there something I need to do? Is there something I need to do for myself? Is there something I'm not seeing? Are there questions I need to ask? Now, this becomes a response as opposed to a reaction.
You know, people often say, don't make any big decisions while you're upset or after some big event like that. But oftentimes, you have no choice but to make big decisions. I mean, if you lose a job
true.
Or, well, if you have to figure out if you're doing a buyout package or if you're going to look for other work, for example. Like that. I mean, it's one thing. Look, if you break up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you don't have to go out the next day and get another one.
Right.
But if you lose a job or something like that, if that's where generally you do have to go out and make some decisions.
But not that day. Not that day. So let's say a job. A job for me, a job loss is classic. And I think it's one of the greatest opportunities that we have, because then you get an opportunity to reframe your vision and get clear about what it is that you're working toward, what it is you're working for, what it is you're working with. Now, most of us will think that we're working for money, but that's not always true. We may be working for some sense of fulfillment or some, you know, deeply ingrained vision that we have. So I say when loss of a job, the first thing you do is get clear about your vision. Forget about where you're going to work or how much you're going to make. What is it that you want to do, to experience, to express, to accomplish? Get clear about that. And then, where can you do that? Where can I do that?
If you're just joining us, we're having a Wisdom Watch conversation with Ayanla Van Zandt. You probably know her from her work with Oprah, her show called Ayanla Fix My Life, or any number of her best-selling books. You know, I'm kind of hearing the through line from you is taking time, even in the middle of a very, what seems very traumatic and upsetting, is stillness. You know, taking
Gotta
some
take time,
time for stillness.
To listen. You have to take time to listen. You have to take time to clear out your brain. I work now in the world, in the television production world, which I haven't worked with normal people for many, many years. I've worked in a self-created, spiritually grounded environment. So now that I'm out in the world with people, and I say, well, I don't understand why y'all are as crazy as hell. Look at how you live. Look, everything is rush, rush, rush. Get it done. Got to go here. Oh, the climb, the talk, the calendar. I'm like, whoo, wait a minute. Hold up. I'm not the one. I can't roll like that. This is how this day can go. And getting people to understand that we are creating it moment by moment by moment with our thoughts, and that we have the power to shape it and mold it and call it forth. People, they don't get it.
People have more control than they think they do.
They have more control than they know they do. Thinking is the problem. Thinking is hazardous to your progress in life. Don't think, feel.
Talk a little bit more, if you would, about their experiences that, you know, people are in transition sometimes for happy reasons, like, you know, they're getting married, mm-hmm. or, you know, they're graduating from college, a big achievement. But then sometimes people are forced to let go of something that they cherished.
And they're
mad. And,
yeah.
You know, as you know, a reasonable person, one would think, would have a right to be. And I just wonder, how do you take the good from that?
If you have a vision that's pulling you forward, anything that happens, you've got to see, how does this align with my vision? And if it looks like with your physical eye, it doesn't align with your vision, what you want to experience and express, then your next step is to say, okay, what are the possibilities here?
Can I ask you a personal question?
Yes.
I hope you don't mind. You lost your daughter.
Yeah.
After a very difficult battle with cancer.
Right.
That you were with her the whole way through. How did you recover from that?
One moment at a time. One moment. I could not do an hour. I couldn't do 30 minutes. I couldn't do a quarter hour. One moment at a time. And the one thing, I mean, looking back on it now, the one thing that I did was I gave myself time to grieve. I stayed in the bed for 6 months. I went days without brushing my teeth. There was nothing I had to do. I was a wounded mama. I had lost my pup. I unplugged. I really did. And I'm glad I did it. And the other thing about it is that now I can say it. I didn't know it then. But now when I look back, I knew she was going. I knew she was going. And that's a transition. That's a change. And what can you do? You can find another job. You can't get another kid.
That's true. Well, thank you for that. Forgiveness?
That's it. That's the ticket. You said one. I said one was tell the truth. Two was forgive. Forgive, forgive, forgive. Forgive everybody for everything. Just forgive and start. Most of us can't start with ourselves. We have to forgive the people we think did things to us. So that's fine. Start there, wherever. Start with the dog who peed on the rug. I don't care where you start.
So much going on in the world today. I think there are a lot of people who feel like they can never forgive. Just as we are speaking now, you know, there's this ongoing violence on the Gaza Strip, ongoing, you know, rockets back and forth between, you know, Gaza and Israel, Israel incursion, you know, many, many hundreds of people dead. And, of course, there's this airline that just got shot down. And I'm sure that there are many people who say, I will never forgive these people, ever.
We see it in the world and we get hysterical or we get upset or we get angry or distressed. But we do it in our minds every day. That kind of thing. We lodge missiles at our family, at our children, at our partners, every day. What's happening is in the world, I believe, this is just me, life according to Iyanla, pay me no mind. What we see in the world is simply a function of what we do within ourselves, because nothing happens on the outside that doesn't first happen on the inside. Everything that's happening in our world is a function of what is going on inside of people. We are violent in our minds. We are violent with one another. We walk past one another in the street and don't even look, won't make eye contact, don't speak. We can be outraged about the missiles and the planes. I'm more outraged that somebody will walk past me in the street and not look me in the face and say good morning. Mm.
Well, thank you for coming in to look us in the face and say, before we let you go, as I mentioned, this is our Wisdom Watch conversation. You've been giving us some wisdom all along the way. So we ask people if they wanted to share some wisdom for people who are listening.
Tell the truth about who you are, what you feel, what you want, what you're up to. Tell the truth about that, first to yourself and then to anybody else that'll listen. And number two, forgive everybody for everything. Forgive everybody for everything. I don't care what it is. Forgive everybody for everything. If you got one little upset in your body about anybody, forgive it. Forgive it so that we can start clearing out some of the mind space and the consciousness of the universe. Forgive everybody for everything.
Iyanla Van Zandt is a best-selling author, inspirational speaker. You can catch her show, Iyanla, Fix My Life, on the OWN Network, and she was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Iyanla Van Zandt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle Martin.
Finally today, it's time for the regular feature we call In Your Ear. These past few weeks, we've been bringing you the favorite music of members of the Tell Me More team. Our next guest is not technically a member of our team. I guess you could say we're a member of his. We're talking about NPR's president and CEO, Jarl Mohn. You heard my conversation with him at the top of the program today. As we said, he's a longtime media executive, including stints at MTV and VH1. But before that, he was a DJ. So you know we had to ask him what's on his playlist.
Hi, this is Jarl Mohn. I'm the president and CEO of NPR, and here are three tracks that are playing in my headphones these days. First one is Future, hip-hop track Look Ahead. Never sacrifice who you are. Never. Then you turn yourself into a star. Turn myself into an avatar. Future. Put the OG in my car. Take a penitential chance at the chance. These shrimp stay caviar. I think the production values are fabulous. It's a very unique track. It doesn't sound like anything else I've heard. Another song in my ear is Black Keys and Heavy Soul. You're calling, come to me. Thoughts of her, don't let me be. I like this particular track. It was in a movie I just saw recently, and it really got my attention. I love the Black Keys for some odd reason, although now that I'm listening to the song, I know it's them. When it went by on the movie, I didn't realize who it was. Yeah.
My final track is an alternative rock one from Alt J, and it's called Left Hand Free. It's a very strange song. This is Yarl Moen, and those are songs that are playing in my ear.
That was NPR's president and CEO, Yarl Moen, telling us what's playing in his ear.